Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Imagine a birthday cake ablaze with 115 candles. It's not improbable. More of us are living to the age of 100 and beyond. According to the Census Bureau, America's centenarian population has grown by at least 65% since 1980. And research is ongoing into the biology of aging, winning the attention of some pharmaceutical and Silicon Valley firms who envision stretching lifespan to at least 120, even 130 years. However, a recent study in the journal Nature argues that 115 is pretty much the limit, and others say there are ethical implications of increasing lifespan. So what do you think of the concept of super aging? Is this something you might want for yourself? The number is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Our guests this hour include David Sinclair, a professor at Harvard Medical School. David Sinclair is also co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biological Mechanisms of Aging. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
And Jay Olshansky is a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Nice to have you back with us, Jay.
Delighted to be back.
So let's begin with some research. Jean Vege is a professor in the Department of Genetics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and he's getting a bit of pushback for a study published in the journal Nature. The study essentially concludes that the limit of the human lifespan is 115 years. Jay Olshansky, could you give us perhaps a bigger overview of what Vege did here?
Well, look, he used the demographic approach, and he asked two basic questions. One is about the maximum lifespan, the longest anyone has ever lived. And we know the answer to that. It's 122. Jeanne Calmon from southern France lived that long. She died in 1997. And what Vige discovered, it's been well known in our field, is that that number hasn't really changed. In fact, to the contrary, maximum lifespan has regressed. So we're not getting anybody living to 120. In fact, we're barely getting anybody living to 115 to 116. And that was one of the reasons why they came to the conclusion that we're not likely to push out the tail of that distribution anytime soon without any sort of major breakthrough in the field of aging. They also looked at the age at which death rates have been declining the most and discovered that really that hadn't really changed much in previous decades as well. And the combination of the two led them to believe that, in fact, there is a limit to duration of life. And, you know, they came to the conclusion of 115, but that's the maximum. The average is really much less than that. It's really likely to be in the mid-80s or so. And I would tend to agree with their conclusions.
Hey, David Sinclair, what do you think?
Well, I think it was a great demographic study looking at human lifespans as they currently exist. And there's billions of us, so it's a pretty big experiment. And I agree with their conclusions that given the current lifestyles that we can choose, healthy diets, exercise, we're not likely to get beyond 122. You know, one in a billion people gets up that close. But what I would argue is that we may be close to breakthroughs. We as a field, over the last 20 years, have made some dramatic discoveries, mostly in labs, but increasingly in human studies, where we may be able to push certainly the average up, but possibly even the maximum as well.
And we're going to get into that in some more detail. But I'd like to point out that James Vopel is head of the Max Planck Oden Center on the Biodemography of Aging, and he calls Vege's study a travesty, which is a pretty strong word. There's a lot of passion about this this question in the field. David?
I think the conclusion that they reached that human lifespan has a maximum is a bit misleading, because it would be like saying in the 1900s that we'll always have infections. By looking backward, it's very hard to predict the future, and I suspect that's why Jim Vopel was upset.
He did look at how survival has changed since the year 1900, and it's true that if you were born in that year, you could expect to live maybe 50 years. So let's just review. Jay, what has changed to help to extend the human lifespan?
Well, Look, a little over 100 years ago, at the beginning of the 20th century, life expectancy was somewhere between 45 and 50 for most developed countries. It's risen by 30 years since then. Women are now routinely living into their 80s, in some parts of the world into their mid-80s. And it's largely a result of reductions in early age mortality. We've saved children, infants and children, from dying from infectious diseases. And so we've added decades to the lives of children. It's been quite a dramatic change in human longevity within a very short time period. Now, here's the difference. In order to get any sort of radical increase in life expectancy, like what Jim Vapel has argued and what others have argued, we would now have to add decades of life to people who have already lived 60, 70, and 80 years. And this is just simply biologically impossible at this moment. There's no evidence to suggest that that is even plausible. So we're likely to be experiencing a deceleration in the rate of increase in life expectancy, possibly even a downturn in life expectancy for some subgroups of the population. We have to recognize that the future is not driven by the past. It's going to be driven by the advances that we make in technology, that like exactly like what David was arguing. The paper by Vij is not suggesting that we can't make progress in reducing old age mortality or middle age mortality. We can. And in fact, the excitement in the field of aging is extraordinary. The kind of work that David and others are doing is really leading us down a totally different pathway than the one that we experienced during the last century. We're now going to be making progress at older ages, but we are butting up against aging itself, and it's a different game that we're playing today relative to the one that we played in the early 20th century.
Well, let's get into some of that research. David Sinclair, what is NAD and why is it being studied?
Over the last 20 years, many labs around the world have made remarkable breakthroughs, mostly in mice and increasingly in primates and ourselves. And what we've discovered is that there are pathways, biochemical pathways in our bodies that protect us against disease, mostly delay aging and push off diseases till much later. But also increasingly we're finding that we can reverse aspects of aging, such as muscle function and metabolism and diabetes. NAD is a molecule that we've worked on for many years now, and it's a molecule that's essential for life. It's throughout our body. And without it, we're dead in 30 seconds. And what we've, as a field, have discovered is that the levels of NAD go down over time as we get older. And at least in mouse studies, if you replenish the NAD levels, either by giving the mice a healthy diet or exercising them, or increasingly we've developed molecules that you can put in the drinking water of the mice, we see profound effects on their health. And others have shown in a lab over in Switzerland, even lifespan extension in those mice, if given at a very old age.
So when you're talking about a lifespan extension, what are you talking about, a year or, you know, in terms of relating to mice? Doubling the lifespan or?
Well, not doubling, though, you know, this is something that we're aiming for, but typically it's commonplace to extend the lifespan of a mouse by about 10 to 20, sometimes 30%. But it depends on when you start the treatments. Typically, it's better to start earlier. And the reason that this latest NAD study was interesting was that they started at the equivalent age of an 80 to 90-year-old human and saw some benefits even then.
Well, and then so as far as humans are concerned, it's a very different ballgame, or no? In terms of this sort of research?
Well, I think that's where the argument comes, particularly in academic circles. Question is, are we going to just translate these studies? Is a 10% gain in a mouse the same as a 10% gain in a human? Or because we live so much longer, will the gains be much less? And I think that's an area where there's debate, and we just really have to go into clinical studies to prove this out.
Let's also talk about resveratrol, which many of us know is found in red wine, and you also work with resveratrol, David Sinclair, in looking at possible anti-aging benefits.
That's true. About 15 years ago, we started working on molecules that might enhance the human lifespan, and It was one of the first molecules that was shown to be safe and effective in mice to protect against diseases of aging, such as diabetes, cancer, and even memory loss. Resveratrol is an early molecule. It wasn't extremely potent. You certainly couldn't drink enough red wine to get the benefits. So you'd need to drink about 100 glasses a day. But what's happened since then is that we have much more potent molecules that work like resveratrol, but more in a drug-like way. And those clinical trials have actually been started in humans with some positive results, though they will not be necessarily marketed or sold or prescribed by a doctor for aging. Instead, the plan is to have them for a particular disease, such as an inflammatory disease or for heart disease, and then we might find that they work to extend lifespan as well.
When you say positive results, what do you mean?
Well, the particular study that's published was a treatment that was developed with a molecule that is related to resveratrol, and its name was SRT-2104, and it was given to patients with the skin condition known as psoriasis. And in a small group of people, I believe it was 80 people, they showed an improvement in that disease. And the next clinical trial is hopefully beginning next year to see if that can be reproduced.
So it seems as if, and Jay Olshansky, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. Some of the research really is focusing on improving what is called health span versus lifespan.
Well, all right, so you took the words right out of my mouth. Work in the field of aging is not really designed to extend life, and that's not what we're seeking. And I don't think David is really trying to seek lifespan extension as a goal in and of itself. My understanding and my feeling is that all of the scientists in the field are pursuing one goal and one goal only, and that's health span extension. We're trying to extend the period of healthy life. Now, here's the dilemma. Remember, we traded off one set of diseases for another, right? We brought down early age mortality from infectious diseases, but what did we get as a result? We got to live an additional 30 years on average for a population. Now we routinely make it out to 60, 70, and 80, but in older bodies, we accumulate risks for a wide variety of diseases and disorders, and the longer we live, the older we are, the more diseases we accumulate in aging bodies. It's called competing risks. So when you reduce the risk of death from one disease, something else eventually pops up. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, something goes down, something else comes up. And that's the scenario that we painted for ourselves today. So we got exactly what we wanted, longer lives, but the price we had to pay was a rise in certain diseases that we didn't really want to see.
All right, Jay, I'm going to have to stop you there as we're up against a break. We'll pick up on that in just a moment on Radio Times. We're talking about the age of 115. Is that the upper limit of the human lifespan? Jay Olshansky is with us, professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois, Chicago, as is David Sinclair, professor in the Department of Genetics at Harvard Medical School. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. 115 years, that's about as old as we can hope to get to be, according to a recent paper in the journal Nature. Some scientists disagree with that. We're talking about that this hour. We'd like to know what you think. Is extending the human lifespan a good idea? David Sinclair is professor in the Department of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biological Mechanisms of Aging. He's along with us this hour, as is Jay Olshansky, professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago and research associate at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. And the number to call is 888-477-9499. I'd like to get to what's going on in Silicon Valley. Google's California Life company, or Calico, is on board with the advancement of anti-aging therapies, and Google's got some deep pockets. So how much can such companies like Calico do to help fuel research, and what exactly is it that they are doing, Jay Olshansky?
Well, this is really good news, by the way. Google's Calico, Craig Venter's Longevity, We've got a group that is called the Longevity Dividend Initiative, trying to accelerate research funding or funding for research in the field of aging. The potential here is huge. And what many of us have argued, what they're arguing, is that the time has arrived for this new paradigm in public health, this new paradigm that's focused on slowing or influencing the biological process of aging as a way to extend the period of healthy life. Now, exactly what Google's Calico is spending their money on is still a secret, and I think that they haven't revealed exactly what their approach is, and I'm not quite sure that we've gotten any additional information from Longevity either. But we just published a book on this topic called Aging the Longevity Dividend, where we describe a broad range of approaches that are being taken to go after aging itself. And the kind of work that David is doing and that others are doing is not just exciting, it's necessary in my world of public health to really attack the kinds of diseases and disorders that we're seeing at older ages. Keep in mind, the idea here is to compress into a very short period of time near the end of life the frailty and disability that's associated with growing older. And I'm confident, as is David, that that progress is going to be made in this area.
So we're talking about, say, the 85-year-old who might be able to ride a bike to work. That would be the goal.
Well, the goal is to really make it take, 80 years to become a 70-year-old or 90 years to become an 80-year-old. We want a slowdown in the rate of biological time so that we can retain our youthful vigor for a longer time period. And it's been done. It's been accomplished in other species. There's reason to believe it can be done in humans. But again, keep in mind the goal here is health extension, not life extension. Life extension without health extension is harmful. And I don't think anyone that I know of is pursuing that.
What do we make of claims from people like Aubrey de Grey, who is chief scientific officer at the Strategies for Engineered Negligible Senescence Research Foundation, if I pronounce that correctly? He says the first person who will reach 1,000 years of age is probably alive today, David Sinclair.
Well, Aubrey's a great conversationalist, and he's very controversial as well. I think one day we'll get to another planet in another solar system, and maybe one day we'll live for 1,000 years. You never say never. But with the technologies that we know of and that I can see within the next 20 years, I just don't see that being even something worth thinking about.
Yeah. Well, and let's just touch a little bit more on the research before we get to the phones. If I'm, again, pronouncing this correctly, senescent cells. What are they, and why is there interest in researching them in regards to prolonging lifespan? David Sinclair.
So senescent cells have been known for a long time, but only in the last 5 years have scientists really been excited about the possibility that they are a major cause of aging. And there's been some really interesting work in mice so far. And what these cells are is that they are cells that stop dividing in our body, but they don't die, and they just sit there in our tissues, and they cause havoc. They increase inflammation, and they promote cancer. And what's particularly exciting is the idea that perhaps we could use pharmaceuticals to kill these cells that are just sitting there. And at least in mice, that seems to have remarkable rejuvenation effects.
But again, Jay Olshansky, not so easy to translate this into humans.
No, but, it's interesting. Keep in mind that in all likelihood, we have people walking among us today that are already experiencing the very phenomenon that we're seeking, which is decelerated aging. People who are making it out to 100, centenarians and super centenarians, people who are making it out past 110, in all likelihood, they are able to live that long because their bodies are probably not experiencing biological time at the same rate as the rest of us, which means 1 year of clock time for them is met by less than 1 year of biological time. And I think what some researchers are trying to do is to discover what it is in their bodies that's contributing to this slower rate of biological aging and find a way to confer that advantage to the rest of us. It's a very exciting line of research, but the interesting thing is we can already see it. We can measure it among people here today. It's very exciting.
Yeah, they hit the genetic lottery, in other words.
Yeah, the only way you can really make it past the century mark or past the 110 is if you had won the genetic lottery at birth. It's not like we're going to transform people who ordinarily would die in their 80s into centenarians or super centenarians. That's unlikely. You're talking about adding 30 years to the life of somebody who's not likely to ordinarily live that long. But some of us are born with that genetic potential. Discovering what that is, how it's working, what the genes are, what the proteins are that are produced by those genes. A lot of work is going on in that area near Barzilai at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Tom Perls at Boston University. Very exciting work.
Yeah. Well, just touch on for a moment the story of Jean Calment, the 120-year-old French woman who passed away a couple decades ago. This is what she used to do, although who knows whether this helped her get to 122. She used to eat more than 2 pounds of chocolate a week, treated her skin with olive oil, rode a bicycle until she was 100 years of age, quit smoking when she was 117. So she seems to be defying the odds there. But a family friend said that perhaps the biggest clue was that she seemed to be immune to stress. She said once, if you can't do anything about it, don't worry about it. How much of a factor is stress in premature aging, David Sinclair?
Oh, there are two types of stress. Psychological stress, I think, is bad. We all know that. It can increase levels of cortisol, which is not going to help your aging process. There's an equally, possibly even more important type of stress that we don't talk about as much, and that's biological stress. And biological stress is an interesting one because if you give just the right amount of biological stress to your body, let's say you're hungry for part of the day or part of the week, or you exercise and your body gets the feeling that there might be some adversity in its environment, these actually can work to your benefit. And so actually what we think is going on with these diets called caloric restriction that allow animals and possibly people to be much healthier is that your body goes into this state of defense mode, and that actually seems to fight against the aging process. And one of the things that my lab and many scientists around the world are trying to do is to find molecules and ways to stimulate that defensive response and put the body into a more heightened state of alert so that it fights against diseases and aging itself.
How much food restriction are we talking about?
Well, in a rodent, we're talking about a 30% reduction of what they would eat normally with free food available. In humans, there have been some clinical studies where people have been given 10 to 15%, sometimes 20% less than what the doctors would recommend. It really means you have to be hungry for at least part of the day. And there are some interesting diets that people are adopting around the world, one called the 5+2 diet, where you eat for 5 days and then you don't eat for another two.
So, Jay Olshansky, is it likely, do you think, that many humans would sign on to eat significantly less food in order to perhaps live longer? And
no. I mean, look, we're doing the exact opposite. I mean, we're eating more and more. We're becoming more obese at a more rapid rate. Even if we told everyone that if you ate less, you would likely live longer and healthier lives, we probably still wouldn't do it. It's not like we don't know what it is that's harmful to us. You know, you tell people that smoking is harmful and they still smoke. Asking centenarians or super centenarians what their secret to longevity is, it's like asking Michael Jordan, what's your secret to growing 6'6"? The real secret is not in what you do or what you don't do necessarily. It's likely to be in your genes. And in fact, the longevity of her ancestors was studied extensively. And the average duration of life of her ancestors going back 10 generations was in the 70s, during the time in which life expectancy in France was in the 30s or 40s. So there's your answer.
All right. As promised, to the phones we go. Wade in Northeast Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Given the state of our healthcare system, what's I don't mean to sound like a downer or anything. Can we really afford to live longer? And, what is that? Is that factored into the conversation here about extending people's lives?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Wade. Jay Olshansky, what do you think?
Yeah, so it's a really, really good question, and it comes up all the time when we're giving presentations on this topic. Now, look, if we weren't interested in extending life, why would we be spending all of this time and money and effort trying to combat heart disease, cancer, stroke, and Alzheimer's? And you could ask the same question about efforts to combat those diseases. If healthy life extension wasn't the goal, then we shouldn't be trying to do that. Now, keep in mind, the world of aging science, if we succeed, just one minor development in the field of aging that would slow down the biological process would make progress against all fatal and disabling diseases at once: heart disease, cancer, stroke, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis. Imagine a pill or an intervention that influenced all of them simultaneously. It would be far more beneficial than a cure for cancer, by way of example. So it's all in perspective.
So, and what do you think, David Sinclair?
I agree with Jay. I think that economists who have done the calculations have shown that it's a cost saving for the U.S. Just a 10% reduction in any one of the major diseases can save trillions of dollars to the economy. So even though it sounds like we're going to have a bunch of elderly people in nursing homes, it's actually the opposite. What we're aiming for is to keep people out of nursing homes to be productive and useful in society for longer.
So perhaps it balances out. If we have less stress on Medicare, there's likely to be more stress on Social Security. David Sinclair?
Well, that's true. As we've seen over the last 50 years, the retirement age needs to be adjusted. But I think it's worth the trade-off. Most people who are healthy love their lives and would be happy to perhaps change a career or help do some community service or look after the grandkids. I think it's a better world. Every time we have a scientific breakthrough in health, the world becomes a better, richer place.
Okay, back to the phones. Matthew is in standing by in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, and you are live on Radio Times. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. I have a bit of an esoteric question. Should we even be having this conversation? And I'm asking that because much of what seems good in our lives is only because we have a sense of our own mortality. I'm thinking of phrases like, live for today. We only get that and we're only motivated by that because we have a sense of our impending death. So do we want to be living longer? Do we want to be trying to strive for essentially immortality? Another example, if some of your fans are familiar with Tolkien's work, the writer of The Lord of the Rings, he had his elves live forever, and they were grieved because they saw the rest of the world passing on without them.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Matthew. Thanks for the call to Radio Time. So Jay Olshansky, might we live less mindfully if we are living to 120 years?
All right. So first of all, death isn't going away anytime soon. Immortality is not in the cards. And I don't think radical life extension is something that is even worthy of scientific discussion at this point. So I think the main concern that he has is not there. It's not real. We're not talking about radical life extension. We're not talking about making us routinely live to 150 or 200. But the point that he's making is a good one. And that is, in a way, end of life gives us a good sense of what it is that's important in life, which is living one day at a time and recognizing the value of life and the importance of life, and especially the importance of a healthy life. That's precisely the reason why it is that researchers in this field are now pushing so hard to extend the period of healthy life, for that very reason, to recognize just how precious each day is, and that when those days are healthy, it just makes life far more rewarding and rich.
David Sinclair, Bill Gates took a poke at the Google company Calico not too long ago. He's quoted as saying, "It seems pretty egocentric while we still have malaria and TB for rich people to fund things so they can live longer." Culturally, there are those who say, why might we be spending all this money on this when there are so many terrible illnesses to contend with now? And questions of burgeoning population, why go there?
Well, I think there's a place for for all medical research. It's not only malaria that's a scourge of the planet. We have old age as a major burden on the economies of the world. China, India, as well as the U.S. and other advanced nations face this problem. And it's going to be a global problem in terms of the cost. And so I think that being able to help and free up money that could be used for other purposes, including helping the developing world, is a very worthy goal. And it's not a selfish goal. Speaking, you know, personally, the reason that I do it, and I think Jay is interested in this too, is that we think this could have a really big impact on humanity in many different ways, economically, socially. And let me just go back to the last question from the last caller. Does this make life not worth living? Do we need to always have carpe diem as we wake up? And I would put it another way. Consider if you could give your mother an extra year of life. You could spend with her and let the grandkids spend with her. Would you refuse that? I would say very few people would do that, especially if it's in good health.
Jay, we have about 30 seconds before we have to get to the break. Would you like to weigh in?
Well, I mean, look, Bill Gates' argument is an interesting one. He's worked very hard to save the lives of children from infectious diseases with great success. But keep in mind, when he succeeds, those children will grow older. And ultimately, they're going to face the very diseases and disorders that we're talking about. So all we're talking about is influencing people in different phases of the lifespan, and I think they both need to be pursued simultaneously.
All right. The conversation continues in just a moment on Radio Times. Jay Olshansky is professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois. David Sinclair, professor in the Department of Genetics at Harvard Medical School. We're talking about improving lifespan and health span here on Radio Times. And again, as always, if you'd like to join us, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Is 115 years the upper limit of the human lifespan? Some say yes. Others say medical research might prove otherwise. We're talking about lifespan, health span, and more with David Sinclair, professor in the Department of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biological Mechanisms of Aging. And Jay Olshansky is professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago and research associate at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. And as always, the number is 888-477-9499. We have an email from Julia who says, please talk about the effect of longevity on the environment, i.e. more people using water, creating pollution, and etc. Jay Olshansky, want to address that?
Yeah, this question comes up all the time. Whenever we're talking about trying to intervene in a wide variety of diseases, people suggest, well, all right, so let's say we succeed and we extend life. Older people will be on the planet for a longer time period using up resources. They might influence population growth in some sort of negative way. And we've actually addressed this argument in several publications, but it's a spurious argument, actually, to the contrary. And you have to keep in mind that the current medical model, which is to go after one disease at a time, heart disease, cancer, and stroke, should have the exact same questions asked of it, just as it is being asked of those of us that are working in the field of aging. Keep in mind, when we succeed in slowing the biological process of aging, we will in fact produce a larger population of healthy older people. Now, it will produce some challenges to be sure for Social Security. In terms of the environment, it's not likely to have much of a significant impact because the absolute number of people will not change actually dramatically at all. The numbers will be relatively small. Now, again, if we cure cancer, if we cure cardiovascular disease, the exact same questions should be arising. The gain in longevity would be roughly the same. So I would say it's not really a reasonable argument for not pursuing health extension by slowing aging.
And David Sinclair?
Well, I tend to agree with with Jay. I think that we absolutely should pursue this. What actually has been a problem for the last 30 years is we've tackled one disease at a time, and what we've ended up with is increasing numbers of elderly with dementia and Alzheimer's. And what we're talking about here is technology that would allow elderly people not just to have healthy bodies but healthy minds as well, which is going to be, when we achieve this, a large relief to the economy and improvement in lives.
All right. Rich in Media has a question that kind of goes right along with this conversation. Welcome to Radio Times, Rich.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just kind of wanted to dovetail off one of the points that you made earlier about, you know, health extension versus life extension. To me, it seems like one's just a byproduct of the other. If you do one or both of them, one, the other one is going to follow. You know, I have a mother that has Alzheimer's right now, and she's been through her 11th year. She's in a nursing home right now, and next year pretty much almost every day. And I just think that, you know, if she had never been, leveled by this disease, she'd probably still be working at 82 and being productive. She was very productive before all this and would be contributing to society. So anybody that is worried about, you know, the idea that it's a drain on the economy or that it's going to somehow, you know, push people out, I couldn't disagree more. I think this is a really fascinating endeavor of a good use of resources. And I just was a little bit confused on the delineation between the two of health extension, because to me, if you increase your health or you enhance your health, I would think the aging, if you live longer, that just kind of follows.
So, Rich, let me just jump in quickly. Would you then want to see more public funds spent in, I think it's called geroscience, the study of aging's biology?
Absolutely, because I think one begets into other fields. I mean, you know, that if there's discoveries made in that field, perhaps it would come up with a cure with Alzheimer's, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I know that the money in Alzheimer's has never really been that strong as it's been in cancer until very recently, and I just feel that my mom got short-shrifted, quite honestly, now that I'm dealing with this disease every day, and I see how devastating it really is.
Yeah.
And she's already beaten the odds by living 10 years or more with it, and I don't see her declining because she kept herself in really good shape from a physical aspect, but her mind's gone, and it's just it's tough to watch. It's really tough to watch, and I just thought I would just chime in.
Sure. Well, Rich, we really appreciate you sharing your story with us here at Radio Times, and take good care. And well, let's get to funding, a little bit more on funding. I mean, James Kirkland, who's a researcher at the Mayo Clinic, says it's harder to grasp. My relative is older, so this predisposes them to a heart attack, so I should give money to research on aging. What is the funding like for the study of aging's biology? David Sinclair, what do you find?
It's atrocious, actually, considering the amount of benefit that that these discoveries could have. The amount of money that goes in the U.S. to aging research is a fraction of a percentage for the basic understanding of aging biology. You know, sure enough, there are particular diseases, cancer, heart disease, Alzheimer's, that get orders of magnitude more money, but I would like to see more money directed at the basic understanding of aging and what we're talking about today because of the huge impact it can have.
Let's get to some more comments. Annabelle writes, who wants to live that long? Your body is frail, your mind goes, health issues abound. No thanks, I don't want to have to rely on others to do basic things like bathe. And a tweet from Matt, is it selfish to continue on and not allow the natural process of dying off and keep our population at a sustainable level? And Jay, again, there's that question of sustainable and population.
Well, I mean, look, I think it was Annabelle was making a particular point. I think this is the whole purpose behind this line of research. It's right. No, thank you. Nobody wants to live that life where they're experiencing dependence, where they're frail, they're disabled, they're experiencing Alzheimer's disease. That's what we don't want, and that's exactly what we're trying to avoid, or at least dramatically reduce in the population today. So I think we actually have the exact same goal in mind. That's what we mean when we say extend healthy life. We're trying to compress whatever it is that we don't like, the no thank you part, into a very short period of time at the end of life. And I would agree with David, it's only a fraction of 1% that is actually going into research designed to slow aging. Again, any sort of minor progress in this field would have a cascading effect on a broad range of diseases and disorders. It would not have any significant impact on the population, in terms of population growth, no significant impact on the environment. It would have a dramatically positive impact on the economy and on the health status of older generations in the future.
And continuing with our callers, Matt in Delaware, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I actually just have a couple questions. You know, as technology grows right now, and, you know, we are evolving on our technology side of everything, AI technology is coming along at a much faster rate than, you know, and more money is being put into that. So I'm just curious on if we download ourselves into a computer, and I know this is hypothetical, but we're probably much closer to doing something like that, and that would extend the life of a human for much longer if we were just put into a computer or put into a machine instead. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't that save all the trouble? And then also the other question that I would have is, what is life in general? I mean, do we need our bodies to live longer?
You, Matt, yeah. Thanks for the question to Radio Times. We're talking about the future and futuristic technologies here. David Sinclair?
I disagree that that's much closer to reality than what we're talking about. What we're talking about today is actually doable within the next few years. It might even be possible right now to go to your doctor and be prescribed a medicine that would delay aging. There are some drugs that are on the market that show some promise already. So we're not talking about the far-flung future. We're talking about being able to do this in the next few years. We just need to prove it in carefully controlled clinical trials. So this is here now. But AI is interesting. So artificial intelligence is actually being used by a number of groups to look at aging, not just to find genes that control aging, but also to measure or estimate people's biological age. There's a company, for example, called Inside Tracker, which I've used. And what they use is artificial intelligence to be able to correlate your blood biomarkers with your age and try to tell you not your chronological age, but your actual biological age. And according to that that Inside Tracker test, last year I was 58 years old. I'm actually chronologically 47.
Uh-oh.
But I changed. Yeah, I was very depressed, very, very depressed. And so I took it upon myself to try to see if some of the molecules that have been developed in the field might work. And it's a small experiment, it's just on myself. But now that Inside Tracker test, that independent test, says that I'm 32 years old biologically.
Oh, well, Jay Olshansky, on those along those lines, tell us about the work being done in facial recognition technology and how that might help people to age better.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, my colleagues and I created a company called Lapidus Solutions, and our focus has been on estimating essentially, in a way, biological age using characteristics of the face. So we know, for example, that the children of long-lived people tend to look younger throughout their lives. They may be chronologically 50, they may look 40, or chronologically 60, and they may look 50. And this is a consistent pattern that we see in the world of aging science. And so, if we can find a way to discover what it is about these individuals that allow them to age at a slower rate, we may be able to confer that advantage to others. And one way to detect that is with the use of facial analytics, a technology that was actually invented by a colleague of mine, Carl Riksenick. So very interesting work.
One quick question as we start to wrap up. Why is it that when you look at today's centenarians, the vast majority of them are women? Jay Olshansky, what's the research say?
Well, the research indicates that females among most species, sexually reproducing species, tend to live longer than the males. Now, exactly why that is the case, it's possible David may have a better answer than I do. I'm not entirely sure why it is that we see females living longer than males, but we do know that it's a consistent pattern. Even when you control for social variables that might influence part of these differences, like smoking patterns and lifestyle, they still persist. So there still is a gender advantage for females. I'm not entirely sure why.
David?
Well, Jay's right. We don't know why, but what it tells us is that there's a genetic component, and that perhaps we could feminize men in a way that allows them to live healthier, longer lives, just like women do, and then take that knowledge and make everybody live even longer.
Okay. One more question. We've got Tom in Lansdale. Tom, welcome to Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning. Terrific discussion. Just a quick question. We've mentioned NAD plus and resveratrol rather, regarding life extension, and wondering what supplements our panel takes and what supplements they might suggest that are actually beneficial.
All right. Thanks, Tom. David Sinclair, let's go to you first, because I'm curious about how you got, I think you said your biological markers went from, what, the high 50s to the 30s? How'd you do that?
Well, disclaimer here that I don't promote any products or sell anything, but I will disclose among friends what I did. So I lost a little bit of weight. It was about five pounds or so. That didn't hurt. Took up a little bit of exercise, which also was a good thing, once a week, running for about 10 minutes. But I think the big impact was that I tried a molecule that we're developing in the lab, which shows aging reversal, some aspects of aging reversal in mice. And this is an NAD-boosting molecule that's not yet widely available, but perhaps one day will be. We hope to do some clinical trials early next year. If anybody wants to look it up, I'm happy to tell you that it's nicotinamide mononucleotide. It's short for, the short form is NMN, and the body converts that into NAD. And if we give that to the mice, they run further. They're resistant to a whole variety of effects of aging. And we should know in the next few years if this really does translate into human longevity and reversal of aging.
And Jay Olshansky, any personal tips for living well into as we age?
Well, first of all, I'm not taking anything. I wouldn't conduct a biological experiment on my own body by taking anything that hasn't been tested using clinical trials yet. Look, the only secret, the only fountain of youth that exists today that we know of that works is diet and exercise.
And even if a long old age runs in the family, medical professionals do say taking care of yourself is a critical factor. Quick quote from Ann Newman, who heads the Center for Healthy Aging at the University of Pittsburgh. Your life expectancy will still be more influenced by how you take care of yourself. If you have a sedentary parent, don't count on living to 100. If you smoke, drink, eat a high-fat diet, and are sedentary and sleep-deprived. So there is that piece of it, David Sinclair. I'm guessing.
Yeah, there is. You have to look after yourself. And even if we are successful developing these molecules and prove them in clinical trials, a healthy diet and exercise will still be important components.
All right, David Sinclair, thank you so much for joining us today for Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
David Sinclair is professor in the Department of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and co-director of the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biological Mechanisms of Aging. And Jay Olshansky, is always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jay is a professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago and research associate at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. By the way, if you get a moment, check out our Facebook page and podcasts by heading to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us.